Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present longtime activist Angela Davis and veteran protest organizer Leslie Kagan, who comment on the massive global protests against the Bush administration's plan for war against Iraq. Greg Pallast, a reporter with BBC Television, who discusses his recent investigation into billions of dollars funneled to Iraq by U.S. ally Saudi Arabia to fund Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapons program during the 1980s. And attorney Nancy Chang, with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who assesses the dangers to civil liberties found in the Bush administration's sequel to the USA Patriot Act, dubbed the Domestic Security Enhancement Act of 2003. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian newspaper reports over a million Palestinians in the occupied territories face the prospect of massive hunger, similar to crises in the Congo and Zimbabwe. UNICEF says 1 in 4 Palestinians is currently malnourished. A recent plea for aid by the United Nations Palestinian Refugee Agency, or UNRWA, fell flat by only getting the promise of a $1.5 million donation from Switzerland. 3 years ago, the UN agency fed 11,000 people on the Gaza Strip. Today, the UN feeds half the Gaza population, or 715,000 people. Before the current intifada began, 70,000 Gaza residents worked in Israel, many laboring on construction projects. Now, only 15,000 day labor permits are given to Gaza workers. The closed border has created a new level of desperation in Gaza. 5 cousins who lived in the Khan Yunis refugee camp were recently killed by Israeli soldiers when they climbed a fence looking for jobs in Israel. Abdulladi Abu Kusa of the Union of Palestinian Medical Relief Committee says, quote, "It's not just the unemployment and disease. There's no hope. No hope for the peace process, no hope that the Israelis will accept us as human beings. These are the worst times Gaza has seen." There are a lot of roadblocks in the path to a new hydrogen era. E, the environmental magazine, reports the Bush administration hopes to use the promise of the new hydrogen car to revive the aging oil, coal, and nuclear industries. Last year, executives from fossil fuel and nuclear companies dominated a government-sponsored National Hydrogen Energy Roadmap workshop. 2 years ago, Shell created its own hydrogen division, and Chevron Texaco has purchased a 20% stake in Energy Conversion Devices, a photovoltaic battery and fuel cell company. Big utilities are also pushing what they call clean coal, which generates hydrogen along with carbon dioxide, with the CO2 being liquefied and stored underground. World Nuclear Association Director John Rich claims nuclear energy can provide, quote, "an entirely clean global economy while also producing hydrogen." Nuclear power does not generate carbon emissions, but it creates other environmental problems, such as radioactive waste, which remains dangerous to human health for generations. The prospect of the new clean hydrogen technology being run by the old polluting industries alarms environmentalists. As Dan Becker of the Sierra Club quipped, "Nuclear-generated hydrogen is like a nicotine patch that causes cancer. If we are looking for the hydrogen economy to be free of the old forms of energy, why would we suddenly go nuclear with all of its well-known problems?" Ski resorts are often a boom-and-bust business. 2 years ago, 3 resort corporations, Vail Resorts, IntraWest, and American Skiing Company, sold a quarter of all lift tickets and controlled sprawling resort areas in Killington, Vermont, Breckenridge, Colorado, and Mammoth Mountain, California. Sierra Magazine charges that the sprawl of ski towns like Stowe, Vermont, have created a serious environmental crisis. Meanwhile, development is being quietly promoted by the U.S. Forest Service, who look to real estate developers as partners in action in national forests. By itself, IntraWest has plans to build 25,000 new high-priced residential units and over 1.5 million square feet of commercial space at 14 ski resorts. The Vail Resort Development Company is selling units in its Beaver Creek ski area for $900,000 a unit after it put in a ski lift nearby. Environmentalists decry the damage created by the ski resorts. Activists say ski runs are permanent clear cuts, and air quality in car-dependent resort towns often flunk federal clean air standards. The new resorts are also a threat to habitat. A new 820-acre golf course next to the Big Mountain ski area displaced grizzly bears, a threatened species. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
During global protests February 15th, an estimated 30 million people in more than 600 cities marched to oppose President Bush's plan for a preemptive war against Iraq. The coordinated actions under the banner of The World Says No to War saw some of the largest demonstrations in recent history, with 3 million marching in both Spain and Italy, close to 1 million taking to the streets of London, and 500,000 protesters gathering in Paris and Berlin. Despite the many obstacles placed in the way of organizers of New York City's protest, about 500,000 gathered within sight of United Nations headquarters to voice their opposition to the Bush administration's drive for war. Although the rally was mostly peaceful, some 300 protesters were arrested, resulting from confrontations with police, triggered, organizers say, by the city's refusal to authorize an orderly march from the UN to Central Park and the penning in of demonstrators far from the speaker's platform. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with veteran protest organizer Leslie Kagan, who coordinated the New York City rally with the group United for Peace and Justice.
It was clearly an incredible day here in New York, but just as importantly, all around the world. And then I think we have definitively, clearly, without question, established that the people of the world do not want this war. And we did our part here in New York to make that contribution.
What do you think the people in the Bush administration are thinking today? Are they reassessing their plan for war because of the outpouring of opposition?
I hope so. You know, I learned a long time ago not to try and get into the heads of the folks in Washington. But I hope that they understand that we are quite serious. Just about every obstacle possible was thrown in the way of this demonstration. Washington and New York City officials both tried to shut this whole thing down. And, you know, somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million people came out anyway. So they better understand that we're not going away and that we think, we believe, we hope, we still live in something like a democracy, and that the voices of the people should carry some weight in setting the policies of this country.
What is the next step here? What are you telling people to prepare for next if the Bush administration continues on the drive for war?
Well, we're urging people to lobby their elected officials, pass more of those city council resolutions, push Congress to intervene in this process. They should not be spectators to this. They should demand their constitutional right to be the declarers of war, not the president. We're urging people to keep the protests up, to lobby in Washington February 25th. 5th, 26th, a national student strike and day of moratorium on February 5th, and a day of actions on International Women's Day all around the country and in Washington. So the protests, the educational work, the media work, it all goes on.
Longtime activist and University of California professor Angela Davis was one of the speakers at the New York City rally.
This is one of the exciting, most exciting moments of my own life, and to know that there are millions of people in the streets all over the world, there are people demonstrating throughout this country. I think this is the best way to demonstrate to the U.S. government that the peoples of the world refuse to follow their lead when they are attempting to lead us to war.
The U.S. media seems to be cheerleading for this war in great measure and ignoring many of the voices of opposition. What does it say about the outpouring of opposition that's come out despite almost a political and a media blackout on the opposition?
Well, I think this is precisely why so many people are coming out. People are recognizing that it is our responsibility to create a political culture that refuses to follow the lead of warmongers in Washington, precisely because the media has not covered the many marches and demonstrations throughout the world, precisely because We have not been able to learn that people in Germany, people in France have been saying no for a very long time. I think that people are taking on their responsibilities in a very powerful and individual way. And this is what's so exciting about this march. There are many people probably who've never been to a demonstration before in their lives, and they now know that it is absolutely necessary to show their faces and to join their voices with the voices of all the rest.
Just one last question. Are there the seeds here of something greater than just opposition to a war in Iraq? Might there be something a beginning of a new
Absolutely.
International movement that can speak
Absolutely.
Out for peace and justice?
Absolutely. It's not, this is, of course, to prevent the outbreak of a war on Iraq. But at the same time, it's a demand for justice against, it's a cry that racism needs to be abolished. It's a demand to end the military-industrial complex, the prison-industrial complex. This is what's so exciting, that so many people have decided to unite for peace and justice, and this, I hope, will be the mark of a new future.
That was Leslie Kagan and Angela Davis in interviews recorded in New York City during an historic day of global anti-war protests February 15th. For more information on the ongoing campaign to oppose a U.S. war with Iraq, contact United for Peace and Justice at area code 646-473-8934 or visit their website at www.unitedforpeace.org. With France and Germany taking a firm stand against a U.S. war with Iraq, officials of the Bush administration, conservative columnists, and right-wing talk show hosts have begun a campaign to demonize U.S. allies in Europe who are resisting Washington's agenda. But with public opinion running 70-80% against war with Baghdad, even in nations whose governments have signed on with the White House, an already serious schism has deepened between America and its European allies. Mr. Bush is perceived by many European citizens as a shallow extremist, with little credibility given the many questions still surrounding the 2000 U.S. presidential election, eventually decided in a partisan Supreme Court. But America's corporate press largely dismisses European concerns with Mr. Bush's go-it-alone policies on arms control, global warming, free trade, and now his drive for war with Iraq. Greg Palast is an American journalist who says he had to travel to Britain to find work, because U.S. media outlets just weren't interested in his hard-hitting brand of investigative reporting. His award-winning front-page stories on the 2000 Florida election scandal, the inner workings of the World Bank and IMF, and the U.S. role in last April's Venezuelan coup attempt for BBC Television and the London Observer, have been largely ignored in the U.S. press. Palast's book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, has been re-released with new investigative reports on several critical issues related to the Iraq crisis. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Greg Palast, who discusses his recent inquiry into billions of dollars funneled to Iraq by U.S. ally Saudi Arabia to fund Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapons program during the 1980s.
We were able to get from a defecting Saudi diplomat documentation that indicated that the Saudi Arabian government gave $7 billion to Saddam Hussein during the Reagan-Bush administration, gave them $7 billion to Saddam to build an atomic bomb, which he didn't complete. And simultaneously, they went on a track to build the so-called Islamic bomb in Pakistan. So when George Bush says, we know this guy has weapons of mass destruction, we know he's hiding parts of nuclear weapons, you have to ask yourself, or at least there isn't a single American reporter which has asked the administration, well, how do you know that with such surety, other than the inspectors which say they aren't finding anything? And the real answer is because we arranged to make sure he had that weaponry. We helped him. In other words, there's nothing, the Saudis cannot give $7 billion to Saddam Hussein unless they got the wink and nod from the administration, from the U.S. government, which at that time was the Reagan-Bush administration. And why do we allow the Saudis to help him build a nuclear weapon? And the answer was that Saddam was our good buddy. We were going steady with him at the time. He was our bulwark against the evil Iranians. At the time, we didn't have an axis of evil. We had a unicycle of evil. It was just the Iranians. So we were happy to see Saddam Hussein shake his bombs at the Iranians. But unfortunately, you have what is called in the intelligence community blowback. We help him build a bomb, and then he turns around and shakes it back at us. So if he has a bomb and piece of a bomb, it's because we gave it to him. And that's something that this administration doesn't want to have a lot of discussion about.
Well, how do you think the insertion of that information in the debate here in the United States would change the outlook of American citizens, particularly when they look at what the Bush administration wants to do to take out this guy?
Well, I mean, what we have is, instead of an evil man, what we have is a renegade employee of the Bush dynasty. And that changes the whole outlook of what we're accomplishing here. You know, they, in effect, they hired him, and now they want to fire him. That's quite different than saying that he's deeply evil. In fact, one of the most fascinating comments I heard was from Condoleezza Rice, who said that Saddam Hussein's regime has been, it's been terribly evil for the past 12 years. Now, that's very interesting, you know, that how could we allow this evil to remain for 12 years? And the reason I find that interesting is he's been in power for 24 years. What she was subtly saying is, for 12 years he was our evil, and but the last 12 years he's kind of gone off on his kind of own independent, unapproved evil. And I think that definitely changes the debate, because we're now talking about something other than great, deep import of whether the Bush administration is really concerned about evil or whether they're just concerned about this particular guy for other reasons. And I could name two, Osama and oil.
Well, tell us a little bit about Osama oil in Saudi Arabia. I know you've also been looking into sources of revenue that supports al-Qaeda and their terrorist network.
One of the problems is that the Bush families had a long political, personal, financial relationship with some of these Saudis that were targets of investigation and therefore were protected from investigation, like the bin Laden family. And most crucially, we discovered through two completely independent sources about a crucial meeting held in Paris in June of 1999. And in this meeting, there were leading Saudi financiers, international arms dealers, and apparently a representative of the financial arm of al-Qaeda. And it was agreed that the Saudis, that each of these Saudis would give certain substantial sums of money to al-Qaeda. Now, this was not, by the way, from our information, to attack America. It was basically a payoff to not attack Saudi Arabia. This was the week of the Khobar Towers massacre, in which al-Qaeda blew up a housing block in Saudi Arabia housing American soldiers. 19 U.S. Marines died. Now, why didn't we stop the Saudis from financing al-Qaeda, and why didn't we follow up more on this meeting? And the answer is a bad policy is obviously number one, and number two, we have to question whether that policy was affected by who attended that meeting. And I can tell you one name that we've gotten from two sources, a guy named Abdullah Baksh. And Abdullah Baksh was also the guy that heavily funded the failing operations of George W. Bush's oil companies in Texas. He was basically a partner and funder of George W. Bush's oil operations and saved the young Bush from bankruptcy. Now, I don't want anyone to misunderstand this at all. These connections do not mean that George Bush said, go ahead, give money to al-Qaeda and let them attack the United States. We have no information like that. What we do have is a problem in which the President of the United States seems to have a prejudice against investigating former partners of his who may be funding knowledgeably or indirectly terrorist acts. And that's a serious failing of our government and needs some public discussion. We have this big problem of the Bush family coming out of the oil industry, which necessarily puts them in contact with Saudi financiers and Saudi businesses. We have to determine to what extent that is prejudicing our policy and left America unprotected. A lot of this material is just coming out in the new U.S. edition of the book because it's the latest material from the BBC Guardian investigations, and we're still uncovering more.
That was Greg Pallast, a reporter with BBC Television and the London Observer newspaper. Read his columns online at www.gregpallast.com. His book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, was recently updated and re-released by Penguin. Almost a year and a half after the September 11th terrorist attacks on New York City and Washington, D.C., civil liberties advocates are continuing to assess the damage done to the American Constitution and Bill of Rights through the USA Patriot Act pushed by the Bush administration, passed by Congress, and signed into law with little serious scrutiny or debate. The legislation has been widely criticized for unnecessarily curtailing civil liberties of citizens and non-citizens, more sharply than at any time since World War II. But as the White House prepares for war with Iraq, officials at the Justice Department have been working behind the scenes to further clamp down on constitutional rights. A document recently leaked to the Center for Public Integrity confirms that the Bush administration is drafting new legislation, dubbed the Domestic Security Enhancement Act of 2003. The bill, which remained secret even from members of Congress until leaked to the press, would prohibit the release of information on people detained as terrorist suspects, create a DNA database of individuals alleged to have links to terrorist groups, and rewrite federal bail laws. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Nancy Chang, senior litigation attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. She discusses provisions of the Domestic Security Enhancement Act and her fear that if signed into law, the bill would further erode civil liberties for all Americans.
This legislative proposal has been dubbed Patriot 2, and it's been dubbed that for the reason that it really follows the coattails of the USA Patriot Act, which was passed in record speed by Congress just 6 weeks after the September 11th terrorist attacks on the United States. And it's very disturbing that it's basically been kept a secret by the Bush administration. The section-by-section analysis and the proposed legislation itself come out to 120 pages. And the draft that the Center for Public Integrity was able to leak to us last week is dated January 9th, and it's basically a very nearly final version of a proposed legislation. Yet the administration was not willing to come forward and answer questions from Congress about its plans until it was leaked. This raises a very cynical question, which is, what were they waiting for? Were they perhaps waiting for a moment at which we were at war with Iraq and Congress was otherwise occupied? And were they hoping to ram it through Congress just as they did the USA Patriot Act? This Patriot Act 2, or Patriot 2, or Son of Patriot, is extremely troubling on a number of fronts. It would go far further than the Patriot Act in terms of limiting our privacy and in terms of allowing the government, in particular the executive branch, extraordinary powers in terms of law enforcement, surveillance, and detention. It would also allow the government to strip us of our citizenship, expatriate individuals, even people born in the United States, and, of course, naturalized citizens as well. It would basically change the nature of our democracy in very serious and very radical ways. And we are fortunate that it was leaked when it was leaked, because now we have a fighting chance to make sure that our representatives in Congress insist on debating this and on making sure that it does not become law.
Nancy Chang, the Justice Department responded through their spokeswoman, Barbara Comstock, as saying that the Justice Department continually considers anti-terrorism measures and would be derelict if they were not doing so. So they're saying they're preparing for events in the future, such as terrorist attacks, that would require further restrictions on our freedoms to protect us. How do you respond to their notion that this thing is just a necessary precaution that they have to take?
I think it goes far beyond that. There's no question, Scott, if the U.S. government had the power to follow each of us around on all of our activities, know what we were doing all the time, plant wiretaps, listen to our phone conversations, read our emails, track our internet usage, get records of our purchases and our banking and financial transactions, find out what books we're reading, find out what political organizations and religious groups we associate with, conduct secret searches of our homes without telling us in advance. If the government could all do all these things, yes, there's an argument we would be safer from terrorism, but I question whether that's in fact so. The truth of the matter is September 11th was probably more the result of communication and analytical failures rather than intelligence failures. We couldn't connect the dots. when our government is overloaded with information, it's impossible for law enforcement to figure out which are the good leads, which are the bad leads, and to spend its time on the productive leads. And also, more importantly, I think we need to question whether we would be any safer if we lived in what would have to be described as a police state, whether we want to have a government that abides by the fundamental principles on which our nation was founded. I think is a very critical question, and I think we all do. We want to have our privacy. We want to have our First Amendment rights protected, our rights of speech and political association. This is all obviously a very difficult time that we're in, and it's a new experience for us. But I think we have to make sure that our government is accountable to us and that it abides by the Bill of Rights.
What about Congress? Do you see any moves afoot in Congress that indicate that this will come under more scrutiny than, let's say, the original USA Patriot Act, which passed pretty much unanimously with very little debate?
I think it will. I think at this point we've seen a Congress that's quite fed up with the administration. I think it's very important to contact our representatives in Congress. So much of our future rests on Congress's willingness to stand up to the administration, not only through oversight of its actions, but through stopping measures like Patriot 2. So they need to hear from us. They need to know what we think. I think that Patriot Act 1 got passed because Congress did not want to be accused of not taking action in the face of a crisis. We have to explain to our representatives in Congress that not taking action makes sense when the action issue is undermining the Bill of Rights.
That was Nancy Chang, senior litigation attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights and author of Silencing Political Dissent, published by Seven Stories Press. Contact the center by calling area code 212-614-6464 or visit their website at www.ccr-ny.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Currie.